KPCW News time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. Let's find out whether we've got some spring-like conditions coming up this weekend. On the phone, I have Thomas Giboy with the ABC4 Weather Center. What are we looking at, Thomas?
Well, Roger, what if I told you it'd be feeling more like mid-spring than early spring today? How would you like that?
I would like that a lot.
It's going to be beautiful across the Wasatch back today. I mean, we're starting off on the mild side of things because we have a strong southerly wind in place, and those southerly winds will continue to increase between today and tomorrow, and that'll help push our temperature more than 10 degrees above our seasonal average. The average high for today in Park City is only around 50 degrees. But this afternoon, we'll see a daytime high likely for the first time this year climb into the low 60s. So it's going to be pretty mild for the Wasatch back as we'll be pushing around 80 degrees here in Salt Lake, just kind of showing how warm it's going to be across the state, while Heber will likely see a daytime high right around 70 degrees this afternoon. A full-on spring feel across the Wasatch back, and if anybody's heading up to the mountain, should be a pretty nice bluebird day, and spring skiing will be in full effect. And I also should mention that we're going to be much closer to our record high today in Park City than our average. So as mentioned, the average for today is 50. The record for today is 67. Don't think we'll quite get there, but we won't be too far away from it. But we'll be looking at mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies with maybe a sliver of a chance for a stray shower up in the mountains. But for the most part, it looks like we're going to get through the day dry. Then tonight, it's partly cloudy skies, the overnight low falling to 39 degrees, and we're right back in the low 60s for our Saturday. So maybe just a fraction cooler than today. And I think we'll probably see a little bit more sunshine than clouds for our Saturday. We're back to the upper 30s on Saturday night. Then we'll start to see some bigger changes in our weather as we go from the end of the weekend into early next week. Now, I think Sunday, for the most part, is still a pretty nice day. It just won't be as warm with a daytime high of 55 degrees, about 5 degrees above our average. And we'll see increasing clouds throughout the day on what is also going to be a breezy day. Then between Sunday night and Monday, our next system moves in from the west, and that's going to spell temperatures likely dropping back below our seasonal averages, with a daytime high coming in at 47 degrees, and there will be a 70% chance of some rain and snow, given our temperature will still be fairly mild as the system isn't going to bring in the coldest air that we'll have seen recently. Then on Monday night, still looking at a chance of rain and snow showers with the overnight low dropping to 33. And over the last couple of days, we've been talking about a system that is probably going to be following the one that comes in on Monday. But the trends with the models show it moving a little bit further to the east with not as much cold air associated with it. I still think we hold on to a chance for a few showers from Tuesday into Wednesday, but that chance might not be as high as our temperatures ease down just a little bit more. On Wednesday, we'll see the daytime high drop to around 42 degrees, and then from Thursday into next weekend, signs are pointing that we'll calm things down and begin to warm things back up. We should be back in the middle 40s by Thursday, eventually back to around 50 degrees by Friday. But we'll just have to see, wait and see just how next week looks. At this point, though, Monday does bring a pretty good chance for showers and those cooler temperatures, Roger.
Doesn't sound like we're going to see much more snow this year, does it, Thomas?
I think for the most part, we've probably peaked when it comes to our snowpack. I'll never say that we won't see any more snow through the month of April. And next week, if everything comes together, then obviously we could see more snow in the mountains. But we are definitely moving more towards the warmer weather than the cooler weather for sure.
Okay, Thomas, thanks and have a good weekend.
Likewise.
Okay, let's find out what these warming temperatures mean for life in the backcountry. On the phone, I've got Greg with the Utah Avalanche Center. Greg, what's it looking like out there?
Yeah, good morning, Roger. You know, first off, I haven't given up on the promise of more snow for this year. So I will take a bet with any of your listeners that we will ski powder, at least good powder, at least one more day this season. But yeah, now these warm temperatures, they just mean spring avalanche concerns, which is wet snow. The good news is, of all the avalanche problems, wet snow is the easiest to handle. It's all about timing. So once the snow surface becomes wet and unsupportable, you want to get off it. If it's firm, if it's frozen, you have a low avalanche danger. And that's what we're starting out this morning, low avalanche danger. Rising to moderate on aspects facing west, south, and east with warming of the day. You just heard those winds. So we do have some southerly winds. They're blowing fairly strong, moderate to strong at the upper elevations. And I think they're going to keep the snowpack cool enough at the upper elevations to keep the avalanche danger low. But if the winds don't materialize, or if just you find your upper elevations and you find that snow surface is becoming wet and unsupportable, it's time to move off of it. So yeah, low danger, rising to moderate, and probably going to be the same throughout the weekend. And also, the UAC, we're done issuing regular avalanche forecasts this Sunday. We'll continue issuing avalanche giving avalanche information through the end of the month, but there'll be no forecast. So we'll be, if there's some significant weather event, we'll put it on our website. We'll also be publishing the observations that we receive from people. So thanks so much. It's been great talking to you and your listeners all season long. And I look forward to have a wonderful spring, summer, and fall. Look forward to talking to you in the fall.
And we appreciate all the information you've given us, our listeners, all season long. Thanks, Greg, and have a good weekend. You're listening to the Local News Hour. This is Roger Goldman. Coming up, I'll be speaking with Miles Redeman about lessons learned from the 2002 Olympics and how they can be applied to 2034. Then I'll be speaking with Ed Parigian with a recap of last night's City Council meeting. We'll finish our hour by speaking with Matt Melville about his upcoming lecture discussing his family's history in early Park City. Olympic officials are in Utah touring venues and infrastructure for a potential 2034 Olympics. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on their first day in the Beehive State.
The International Olympic Committee's Future Host Commission, along with IOC and Olympic and Paralympic leaders, met with Utah's Olympic Bid Committee at the University of Utah Wednesday. There, Utah presented its vision for the 2034 Olympic Games with Elevate as the main theme. Utah's Bid Commission said the state wants to elevate local communities, elevate sport, and elevate the Games experience. The commission also wants to unify people at the community, state, and national level. Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall said Utah is one of the fastest-growing states in the nation, so many current residents didn't get to experience the 2002 Games. Yet, 80% support the Olympic Games coming back. Further, Mendenhall said 100% of Utah's political leaders support the return of the Games.
It has nothing to do, and it actually supersedes politics. It's an example that I know our governor and lieutenant governor are proud of in the state of Utah, the secret sauce we call it, where we come together to do hard things.
Mendenhall also said the games align with Utah's goals. By 2030, Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, and Summit County will have 100% net renewable energy, something appealing to the IOC. The state is also working to bring in more passenger rails, which would also support the Olympics. The Future Host Commission appreciated how Utah has galvanized the Olympic spirit, continuing to draw global competitive events. Since 2002, Utah has hosted over 1,100 summer and winter sporting events, and athletes from more than 30 countries train in Utah. Catherine Rainey Norman is a four-time Olympic speed skater and the chair of the bid committee. She said Utah cultivates young athletes.
It's not that the games are going to make something happen that we weren't going to do anyway. It aligns perfectly with our future ambitions. And we know that the games can and will be a catalyst to better achieve our ambitions.
Future Olympic Commission Chair Carl Stoss said the 2002 Games had the most attendees of any winter sporting event. That year, Utah officials worked to improve the Games experience. Tanya Kari, a former Paralympian, said the 2002 Games was the first to have the same organizing committee for the Olympics and Paralympics.
I felt the difference here. It was quality, it was welcoming, it was absolutely excellent delivery of the Paralympic Games.
Rainey Norman said Olympic athletes said more resources for their families would help during the Games. That's why Utah is launching an athlete family initiative to help athletes' relatives find affordable housing, tickets, and transportation during the 2034 Games. Fraser Bullock, president of the Utah Bid Committee, said all Utah venues are within an hour of the Olympic Village.
I remember back in 02, I could go to an event in the mountains in the morning. I could go to speed skating in the afternoon. I could go to figure skating downtown or short track, all in one day, 3 to 4 events in one day. It was spectacular.
The Future Host Commission complimented Utah's preparation, specifically its cultivation of young athletes and Olympic venues already built. Christoph Duby, the Olympic Games executive director, said young people are the future Olympic leaders.
At some point, we'll be replaced by a new generation of management. This is the same for the foundation. This is the same for the commission. So this is the opportunity to work long-term.
Stoss wouldn't confirm if Utah will be awarded the 2034 Games, but said he has a good feeling about it. Salt Lake City is the preferred host for the 2034 Games and is the only official host being considered. The IOC will select a host for the 2034 Games on July 24th, or Pioneer Day in Utah. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The 2002 Olympics was a watershed event for Utah and for Park City in particular. On the phone to talk about how Park City prepared for the Games and some lessons that could be applied as we prepare for the likelihood of Games in 2034 is Miles Redeman. Morning, Miles.
Good morning, Roger.
So, Miles, why am I talking to you? What was your role at the city in the run-up to the Games, and how did you first get involved?
Well, I got involved. I was the planning director in Park City in the late 1980s, and our mayor, Brad Ulch, was very involved in getting the Olympic Games to come to Utah. And I remember him coming into my office. It must have been 1988, maybe 1987. Even he said he got a call from some people in Salt Lake, and they were talking about bidding again for the Games. Salt Lake had bid before for the Games in the 60s, but never got them. And he said to me, what do you think about that? And I said, there wasn't much going on in Park City in those days. I said, well, I don't really know much about the Olympics, but it sounds like a great idea to me. And that started a journey that lasted almost 15 years of planning and executing the Games in 2002.
So when would that first conversation have taken place?
Well, as I said, the first conversation, I think, is when Brad got a call from the people who were the beginning of the organizing committee in Salt Lake. And they were very interested in having those of us in Park City involved, not so much because they wanted our advice, because we didn't have a lot of advice to give, but they wanted us to organize the venues up here and to also tap into some of the money that could come from Park City.
So I assume this was probably, you know, 4 or 5 years, obviously many years before the Games. This process obviously takes a long time.
This was like 13 or 14 years before we
right.
did the Games.
So tell me, you know, how did things proceed from there? What role did the city play in trying to help
these Well, number one, the first bid was for the 1998 Games, which we lost. We lost that bid to Nagano, Japan. And I won't go through all the history of that, but then in 1995, we won the right to host the 2002 Games, and we won that bid in Birmingham, England. Because in those days, you bid or you won the bid 7 years in advance of the Games, so you had 7 years to prepare. Here we're talking about 10 years to prepare, which is even more daunting in some ways. You know, because a good deadline always helps you to prepare. It sort of focuses your mind.
It focuses your mind.
But there was a lot of work, and I like to kid about it. But there's some truth to this, and that is that we work very hard to make ourselves known, to gain some expertise in what we were talking about. We took it seriously. So I think the success of our Games in 2002 was attributable to 50% great planning and 75% incredible luck. So when all is said and done, luck is a very important factor in hosting a Games.
So let's talk a little bit about how preparation gets organized. Obviously, you are a city employee. There's lots of other stakeholders. How do the stakeholders get together to try to figure out a plan, and how is the sort of preparation organization governed?
Well, in those days, Olympic Games was only awarded to a city somewhere in the world, not to a country, not to a state. It's sort of changed over time. I think it's still officially a city that gets the bid, and it was Salt Lake City that bid for the Games. We were just one of the major venues. Actually, we hosted about 50% of all the events, and I think that'll be true again for Games in 2034. We were like a new seat at the table. I'm not sure a lot of people wanted us sitting at the table, and we had to kind of push our nose under the tent and to become part of that. And we did that by just taking it seriously, and we went to the city council very early on. I remember Brad and I talking. Brad was mayor for three terms, and we went to the city council, and we said, look, if we want to do this, we have to take it seriously, which means that we have to devote some money and some time and effort into learning about the Games, about attending other Games, and finding out what this means, and about, you know, separating the myth from the reality. And I think we still have to do that. People have inflated ideas of what the Olympics can be. But I guess now, after all these years, people are a little bit more savvy. We were not very savvy in those days. Brad knew a lot about the Games, but the most of us didn't. I mean, we'd seen them on television or so forth, but we didn't really know anything about organizing the Games. And what we really took was a community-first approach to doing the Games. We didn't run the venues. We didn't run the sports events. We ran sort of our community. And since our community was going to be a focus for so many of the sporting events, We want it to become kind of the party town. We want it to be the social hub of the Olympics, and I think we accomplished that.
Talk a little bit about the sort of money flows. I mean, you know, obviously, Olympic Games creates an enormous disruption, which has to cost the city money in terms of safety, in terms of all those other issues. How did money flow? Was the city compensated?
Well, actually, there's not as much money involved as people think. I'm saying this is sort of the myth and the reality. And again, Park City now has hosted a lot of big events over the last 22 years since we hosted the Games. But even before the Games, we had been hosting Sundance for a good number of years. So we were not unaccustomed to hosting. We also had World Cup skiing here that the Badamis really put on. Nick and his son really pioneered that. So we were used to hosting a certain level of events. What we realized was the Olympics was just a regular event writ large. And again, the myth of how big it was going to be and the reality of what it really was is different. And we saw that, and we attended five previous Olympics before we hosted. So we got to see firsthand how other countries were handling it, what was done, what was successful, what wasn't successful. And we were able to tailor make, I think, what we learned. And we spent a lot of time talking to our community and bringing them in. So we did a lot of process, a lot of meetings, hundreds of meetings. But at a certain point, we realized, and we made it very explicit, that there was a time for planning to end and a time for implementation to begin. And so 18 months prior to the beginning of the Games in 2002, we said, no more planning. It's time to implement the plans that we made, and we stuck to that. And so people always ask me, what did you learn from that experience? And I kid about it, but it's true. I said, I learned how to say no. Because in order to say yes to certain things, you have to say no to a whole lot of things. So you don't go down too many rabbit holes, and you concentrate on what you have to do in order to host a successful event.
I think that all of us appreciate the sacrifice that you must have had to go to five Olympic Games as part of your job, Miles.
But it was horrible. I mean,
but it sounds as though you think that...
I didn't go to all those five. I mean, we sent delegations. I went to at least three, though.
Okay. It sounds as though you feel as though you did a number of things right.
We did.
And as you, if you were sitting down with the mayor, which I suspect you probably are, what kinds of things would you be saying to try to profit from that experience? In other words, how would you try to replicate what you guys did right? And I'm also going to ask you about what you did wrong in a minute, but let's start with what you did
right.
Yeah,
that's fair. And I think, I think the council, the mayor, and the Matt Dias, and the staff, they have a very clear idea of how this is going to go because the experience is so deep now. We didn't have a very deep experience in the city prior to this. But I think the one thing we did absolutely right is we said to our staff, this is not something that's going to be laid on top of us. This is something we are going to help create for ourselves. And so we're not hiring, a million consultants and doing studies and all that. We're going to do it ourselves. We're going to develop our own expertise. So we saw it as a chance to grow as individuals and as a community. And I think we did that very right. And people did step up. And luckily, so many of those people who did participate in that learning experience are still here. Are still here in the community. And so we have people at the city like Jenny Dearson and Dave Gustafson and others who are here and who went through it and know about it. And we also have people like Colin Hilton and Fraser Bullock and all who went through it. And so there's a deep knowledge in Utah and in Park City about what a Games can do, how you can do it. So I'm not at all worried about that. I mean, we were babes in the woods, but we're not any longer. People come from all over the world to see how we did it. So I know that, we developed some expertise.
And what would you point to as any mistakes that you made, things you would advise the city to do differently this time?
Well, I think, it's not so much mistakes, but we spent a lot of time, or at least I spent a lot of time. I was, I'm not a big sports person. I mean, I know how to ski, but So we didn't really associate so much with the sporting events. The venues and all that, there are experts who do that and do it very well because of all the World Cups we put on every year and the ski resorts and so forth. They have that locked. What we had to do as a community is say, how do we welcome the world? Because that was the mantra of the Olympics. The world is welcome here. So first we have to understand and we have to test, do we still feel that way? if that's going to be our North Star, and it was our North Star for the 2002 Games, are we willing to welcome the world here and act as hosts? That all has to do with hospitality, being hospitable, and making sure that we do welcome people and we make them comfortable and safe and provide the services that are needed and kind of the party that's needed. So I said we were more in charge of the party than we were of the sporting events, but we learned from other Olympics that probably half the people that attend an Olympics never go to a real Olympic event. They're just there to be there. They're onlookers, they're bystanders, they're family members. Maybe they'll go to one event if they have a family member skiing or ice skating or playing hockey or something. But the rest of the time, they just want to be part of the scene. And the scene is very important, and it includes things like pin trading and bands and celebrations. Because really what you're trying to do is you're trying to present an aura of peace and people coming together and striving for the best they can. I mean, one of the mantras of the Olympics was light the fire within. And that's still true. I mean, there's a certain amount of spiritual gusto to this whole thing. And we tried never to lose sight of that. We tried to really honor that spirit. And I think we were successful in doing that.
Miles, before we go, I don't think anybody would dispute that the 2002 Olympics really changed Park City. We can talk about whether it was for the better or not, but I think it was. But talk to us a little bit about your reflections on how it changed Park City and how you think that the next games are likely to change Park City.
Well, Park City was already changing. I mean, some people, who weren't here or maybe, did it throw some fuel on the fire? Yes. But the reason that we even got involved with the Olympics initially, when the mayor came to my office and we talked about it, we were really striving to get some recognition as a resort area, Park City. I mean, I don't know if many people remember the name Rodney Dangerfield, but he was a comedian that always talked about we get no respect. And that's the way we felt in Utah in our skiing industry, that, there was Colorado and there was California and there was Whistler and all that. But people didn't really respect, I think, what we had here in Utah. So part of what we wanted was brand recognition. Mm-hmm. We wanted to honor what we had here and expose the world to that. So that was very clear to us. And again, that was a North Star, and I use that term again, because that means that you have a goal in mind and that you're everything you're doing is working toward that goal. So we were looking for international recognition. People said we wanted to be a world-class resort. We also said we wanted to cover our costs. So we were very frugal in the way we approached the games. We didn't have any this wasn't the Super Bowl with, halftime, big stars. We had trash can bands and marching bands of the kids and so forth. It was a real down-home kind of celebration. And I think, unfortunately, in the years since we did the games, the Olympics kind of lost some of their luster. They got kind of tied up in things, and some of the places that hosted the games, very authoritarian regimes. I think we have a chance now, again, to reinvigorate the Olympic movement about the things that we care about, sustainability, community, hospitality. I think those things are very important. And I think Park City can lead the way along with the state of Utah.
Okay, Miles, thanks for taking the time to talk with us this morning.
It's my pleasure, Roger.
We'll be right back.
Have a good weekend.
We'll be right back.
Bye-bye.
I want to add an additional lost and found announcement. My dog is missing. Her name is Zuzu. She is missing in the Park Meadows area. If you find her, please give us a call at 202-277-7260. She's a young golden doodle, very rambunctious. We hope she turns up soon. Now, I want to welcome to the studio Ed Parisian to talk about last night's city council meeting. Good morning, Ed.
Morning, Roger.
My sense is that the highlight of yesterday's meeting, and you certainly could correct me, was the work session on 248.
It was. It was a study session.
Okay, tell us about
which means we go into the back on the tables. Mm-hmm. So that's I learned that yesterday. Difference between a work session and a study session. That was good. It was like an hour and a half. We had the consultants from Harks over and just trying to figure out what's the solution.
For many people, sort of 248 is probably one of the top issues that or challenges that the city, the city faces. Now, there was a time a few years ago where there was a proposal from UDOT to widen the road, which I take it, which was never taken up.
Right.
Now we are where we are. And my understanding is that the consultants or that the staff report laid out, I think, three alternatives as to where to go from here.
Right.
Can you lay them out for us?
Yeah, it was, let's see, the first one was a full-blown, I got my notes here, I'm trying to think, pretty much stay as is.
That was, I see, is right. Article, right?
Yep. Do the alternate needs assessment. That was plan A. Plan B was advanced bus rapid transit as a solution, or third path was keep it as is. So obviously we don't want to keep it as is. So we had a, we didn't come to any conclusion as to A, B, C. I think it's all of the above.
Okay.
The key to the whole thing, I mean, it's a difficult one. I don't even know the answer. And I know all the answers.
Well, you probably don't know the answer yet.
No, but I want to. It's complicated because I was just reading a newspaper article this morning. It said, in order to solve the problem, we have to measure the problem. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we need to go is like, how many cars are there? You hear 7,000, you've heard 8, 9, 10, 14,000 cars. To get the solution, you got to kind of know, to me anyway, what that number is. So I can know how many I can get on a bus, what, I mean, so we can measure it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we've measured it yet. We've done the right things, I think, to get where we're going, but I don't know we know the extent of what is the problem and what we can do to solve the problem. So basically they were saying you can do the full-blown bus rapid transit with the full lanes straight in. You have the bus stations all full, and they were saying that's $20 million a mile. And I'm like, I don't know if we can do that. Well, we have the lanes. So we have a park and ride, right? Mm-hmm. We just started that last year, the bus rapid transit lane. So I think that's where we're going to head. Maybe we have to refine that a little bit and maybe make it a little better, get rid of the choke points, as it were.
Now, as I understand it, one of the big issues, and the sort of A-B distinction, if you will, was that in order to try to leverage the potential for some federal funding,
yeah,
you need to have, before the feds will look at you to give you money, you have to have what,
a NEPA
study, right, which is an environmental impact,
right,
I think, kind of study. So the potential, obviously, that I would assume that the potential to attract that kind of funding is pretty important in terms of
if we go with a $20 million a mile option, it is, that's for sure. So we gave the signal to go ahead, let's look at that, because all federal money is good money, right? I think, maybe. I shouldn't say that. But, yeah, I mean, we're going to do it right. I mean, I think this council and the mayor, we're ready to do this.
And the do this, I tell you, was the result of all this to sort of an oak? Did you give the consultants the green light to go ahead and do the next phase in terms of where did it end is what I'm trying to say.
It ended where we want some numbers. I particularly, and I think the rest of the country, we want to know the extent. When I hear people say we have anywhere from 8 to 14,000 people coming in a day, I'd like to know, is it 8 or is it 14?
Sure.
And what time of year is the 8, what time of year is the 14,000 people? So, like I said, you got to know the problem to solve the problem, right? You gotta. Mm-hmm. I'm an ex-accountant.
Recovering account.
Right, there you go. Right. I've lost my balance a little bit, as they say.
That's to your credit.
But, yeah, so I think, you know, we decided that probably bus rapid transit is the solution right now, before we get into anything else like light rail or anything else. That's the cheapest, probably most effective solution with what we got. So we're going to go on that. We're going to get the numbers. We're going to figure out where the park and ride or two need to be. But it's basically going to come down to changing behavior. Right? I mean, I can't make people get on a bus. Mm-hmm. I can't make people do anything. So we've got to know, how do you incentivize? How do you get people on this bus that's going to be a quicker ride? So that's the challenge, I think.
And just to bring some clarity to it, is there a deliverable that you've asked the consultants to do, and when do you think they'll come back with it?
Well, they're going to come back soon.
Okay.
The deliverable will be... Measure the problem.
Measure the problem, okay.
And then we're going to see what the solution is. Because we were talking about high school, for instance. How many high school kids have to drive in or with their parents or whatnot? And so how do you know? You can't just say, oh, let's look at that without knowing how much it is. So things like that. We want to know how many high school kids need that road, how many workers need that road, and... go from there and see, all right, where can we make some progress here?
And you mentioned, I think, that before we talk about things like light rail, you want to, you sort of figure out the problem. And right now you're still in the bus rapid transit sort of area.
Yeah.
But is that off the table? I mean, will the consultant come back with the potential of other more sort of dramatic, if you will, kinds of solutions? Is that still possible?
Only if this doesn't work. I mean... light rail is so expensive, mm-hmm. And where do you put it and this and that? I mean, we have the road for the bus now. That's the logical solution, right now, and that's where we're headed. We have buses. We have the lanes made. So I think we got to see bus rapid transit fail miserably.
Okay.
To go to the next level, but you never know.
You talked about incentives and changing behaviors. One of the things we learned, I think, this year was that simply improving the number of buses, the ease of use at Richardson Flat caused you to have this rather dramatic increase in usage.
Yeah, I think that's the key. I mean, I'm pretty much grown up in cities and I've taken all the, and you need to just have them fast service, regular frequency. So you don't need maybe a schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You show up, the bus comes. And that's how I always did it. I show up for the bus comes, it takes me to the subway shows up, and I never have known schedules. It comes. And I think, to me, that's the key to getting people on the bus so they don't have a half-hour wait or even a 20-minute wait. Maybe it needs to be 10 minutes. Boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. You get there, you're serviced, boom, you're out. That would make it easy for me, that's for sure. So we'll see.
Okay, I know that one of the things touched on last night was the capital budget staff report. Anything significant or highlights that our listeners should know about from that?
No, it's got... that was just a preview, so it's very preliminary. But they started with those because those are kind of etched in stone, the new... pools at the Mark, the new rec center building at City Park. There's some money in for the City Hall remodel if we choose to go that route. So I don't think anything surprising in there.
Did they also have the money for the partnership with Deer Valley for the,
yeah, we've got that, that in. A, yeah,
we got that. Pass deal. Yeah.
Yep. Got okay. That in there. So nothing major. Roger.
Okay, there was a report on fees for fiscal year 25. And of course, I immediately turned to the part that talked about golf. One of the things I take it the city is trying to do was to subtly, but not insignificantly, improve sort of the benefits for residents as opposed to non-residents with respect to recreation facilities.
Right. If we're going to raise fees, which you always have to raise fees because the costs always go up, and we're trying to get it so the locals get as much a deal as they can, given the interlocal agreements we have with Summit County. So we just want to make, if we're going to raise fees, it'll be for non-county mm-hmm. use at the golf course specifically. And then the other, like the rec fees and the ice rink fees will go up a smidge, but not a whole lot.
The last thing I want to touch on before we go is what I think is a quintessentially local issue, which is this complicated discussion about a single condominium and the potential for the sale of it. Can you sort of explain that one?
Well, that was a touching story, too, because there's a couple with their two kids that live in this condo over at Claim Jumper, and they wanted to buy it, and the owner wanted to sell it to them. But they're in number three on the wait list, so you can't jump above number one and two. So what we did at the end was say, all right, let's see if number one and two on the list want this. And if they don't, then the number three, the current tenants, will have the opportunity to buy it. So we didn't decide specifically because there was a difference between affordable and attainable, and HOA fees come into it. But the bottom line is we want these people to stay. They've been there for 8 years. They've been in Park City for 20 years. And their dream is to own something in Park City. And, you know, that's what we want, right? So we're going to make every effort to see that they can stay within their affordability range.
Ed, is there anything else you want to touch on before we go?
What else? Well, I'm going to go skiing in my shorts, hopefully in the next 3 or 4 hours. Well,
if you wait too long, it's going to get kind of slushy out there.
Oh, that's slushy.
It's going to get 60 degrees.
I love the slushy. Just go steeper.
Okay, Ed. Be careful out there. Thanks for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this. The efforts of Park City's nonprofit Hope Alliance were validated this week by a new study that found that when older workers were given free reading glasses, they earned a third more than those who do not have them. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has more.
Hope Alliance began 25 years ago with a much broader mission than vision care, but today it focuses on providing eyeglasses to those who otherwise wouldn't have access to them.
So that could be for a number of reasons. It could be because you live in Uganda in a primitive area that there just are no glasses. It could be because you don't have insurance and your family can't afford it here in Utah.
That's the executive director of Hope Alliance, Diane Bernhardt, who added that even a $15 pair of glasses is out of reach for some. She says a recent study found that when older workers in Bangladesh were given reading glasses, they were able to earn 33% more money and their quality of life improved as a result.
We were very excited to read this article because this is something that we've known, well, we all can know sort of anecdotally. Hope Alliance has known firsthand the ramifications it can make by having a pair of glasses, not just from an income perspective, but also from an educational perspective, from a interpersonal perspective. If you can't see someone's expression on their face at a distance, communication drops.
Hope Alliance uses volunteers to help with their traveling eye clinics every year in Guatemala, Mexico, and Uganda. While the organization has been limited to providing free eye exams and eyeglasses, Bernhardt says they're very close to finalizing a partnership with iCor that can help with another debilitating vision problem that they haven't been able to help with until now, cataracts.
They're located in Boston, but they have a presence here. They serve in 3 locations in Tanzania. So we're setting ourselves up to go to Tanzania, meet them there in the beginning of November, where we would set up that model of doing the refractions, identifying them, and then they would do cataract care for the camp that's there, but also they have a doctor there that will do the continuation.
Links to a few published reports about the study, including here on NPR, can be found online at kpcw.org. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
Well, in the studio with me, we've got Matt Melville. Next Wednesday, Matt's going to be giving a lecture about Henry Shields, an early pioneer of Park City, who just happens to be his great-grandfather. Morning, Matt. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
So, Matt, let's talk a little bit about Shields. Where was he born, and how did he make his way to Utah?
Yeah, so first I just want to thank Park City Museum for allowing me to give this lecture next Wednesday over at their collection center over on Sidewinder Drive. It's going to be next Wednesday, 5 o'clock. My great-great-grandpa Henry, he came, born and raised in Belfast, Ireland. And so he came over as a young child at the end of the potato famine to the United States, looking for a new life.
Late 19th century, 18?
Yeah, he came over here, it probably would have been, he was born in 1842. I think he was about 9 or so when he started coming across.
Yeah,
1850s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so he came at the end of the potato famine.
Mm-hmm. Just spent time going back and forth on some of the ships, lived on the East Coast for a little bit, and then made his way west. I think it was the draw of some of the mining things. Initially, he did some work on the Mississippi River, came to Montana, Butte, Montana, did some mining there, and then got word of mining in Utah and came to Alta in 1871. He started doing a little bit mining there and then realized mining probably wasn't the best type of work to be in. You know, it's so dangerous and hard work. And he started doing a little more law enforcement. That's where he got into law enforcement. He was one of the early constables there in Alta. And then he lived there in Alta for about 7-8 years. And then 1879 came across the hill over here to Park City. And that's where he spent the rest of his life.
I guess I hadn't realized there were significant mining operations in Alta at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
And so he gets involved in law enforcement. One of the things that you showed to me was this article about the Goggins Barker trial. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this was a wild article to read. I initially found it reading the Park Record, and then found the original article, which was done by, it was called the Goodwin's Weekly magazine. But basically, when he was there in Alta, there was a gentleman that had a dugout area, kind of like a root cellar. Another gentleman had a couple mules. The mules went on top, it collapsed it. So this guy was mad that it collapsed his dugout. The mule broke its leg, so they decided to sue each other. And at the time, that Henry, I believe, is an officer of the peace, some type of judgeship
Justice of the peace.
Justice of the peace, yeah. And they went to trial. He was the judge at that time, and it was took place down at Oddfellows Hall in Salt Lake. And it sounded like it was just a wild event. This just sounds like something out of the Follies, because he was going down there. There was the whole town of Alta came down to see what was going on in this trial. There was music, entertainment going on, and a lot of different things mixed into this trial. And there was a band playing. Henry showed up late. The band was singing. There was also one of the mine managers brought his famous pit bull down, and his pit bull was sitting in the judge's chair, and people were singing this chorus. Henry came in, and he was so upset that there was just all this commotion. And he had a revolver. Took out his revolver. He was so upset, and I guess really mad at this dog in the chair, unfortunately. And he took out his gun and he tried to shoot the dog. I guess what happened in this story was all of the chambers, this old revolver, went off at the same time. The dog wasn't shot, but I believe it was one of the plaintiffs or defendants ended up getting shot in the leg by him. The trial went into commotion, smoke everywhere, people running. And eventually, I guess what happened in that trial, they settled it. And one of the guys ended up giving the other guy the lame horse or mule,
the mule
as part of the trial. But just a wild time. If we were to go back to, you know, those times in the 1870s, I like to think of the movie Tombstone. Mm-hmm. It's about that time. And so just wild, wild west. The early days of Park City, those first 20 years or so, there was about 30 different murders at that time. And so it was literally the wild, wild west here way back then.
So your great-grandmother also, is it great or great-great?
Which? I mean...
Your grandmother.
My grandmother, yes. My grandmother was born here in Park City.
Your great-great-grandmother, who married Shields...
Yes.
...also has an interesting story.
Yes,
tell us about her.
She does. Araminta Bates. She was born in Tooele, polygamous family. Her father was Oramus Bates. I say that he was probably one of the most prolific breeders of the 19th century. He had about seven, eight wives.
You're not talking about puppies.
No, exactly, humans. He had about 7-8 wives at the time. And what we know is probably 46 children at least. And so that was her father. She, and then actually her uncle was Orson Pratt. As we know, Parley Pratt, Orson Pratt, famous Pratt brothers here, early Mormon pioneers. She actually was... She was married to her uncle there out there, which is really awful. I imagine that wasn't...
Was he polygamous also?
I believe so, yeah. They were married, and she had 6 miscarriages with him. Obviously, that wasn't a healthy relationship. I'm sure it was forced. And she left.
Mm-hmm.
She escaped. And so at that time, she came up to Alta to work in some of the boarding houses, kind of like the hotels. And the mining area was a place where the Mormon church really wasn't.
Yeah.
And that's where she met Henry, her knight in shining armor. And so, yeah, that's where they initially met. They came over here, got married, settled in the old, our old family house, which is located directly north of the Catholic Church, the Old Town Catholic Church, mm-hmm. 139 Park Avenue. And that's the house that my grandma was born in as well.
Okay, so they come to Park City. What does he do here?
He initially came, and he, one of the first jobs he had was deputy sheriff here. So the Park City Museum, just right here down the street from where we can see the old dungeon down there, he was in charge of the jail and law enforcement in those early days. And in that time frame from, you know, I think it was the first, from about 1881 to 1885, there was 13 murders. Just in those 4 or 5 years. This is a town at that time that maybe had 15, 1600 people in it. And a 4 or 5 year time period, we had 13 different murders. Some of them very infamous, like the Black Jack Murphy lynching that happened at the bottom of Main Street.
Tell us about that. What caused that lynching?
Yeah, that was, it's an interesting story. There's lots of information on that through the museum. But there is some sort of a dispute, and one of the gentlemen was murdered. I forget his name, and they all thought it was Black Jack Murphy. They took him up to the jail up in Colville, and I found an article that said that Henry, he was one of the deputy sheriff at that time. His recommendation was that they take him down to Salt Lake because the city was so much unrest. They were really upset at this murder. I guess he murdered a very influential person, allegedly. And the city was upset with all that was going on, with all these murders. They felt like there wasn't enough justice in town. And then this group of people commandeered the train. They went up to Colville to the jail. They basically broke Black Jack Murphy out of the jail, brought him back to Park City. There's reports that some people think he might have been killed before he got here and was lynched at the bottom of Main Street. There's a whole slew of things that can be talked about just about that story. Mm-hmm. Just a terrible time in our history. And it was actually 3 or 4 days after a lynching that happened in Salt Lake as well. Had they heeded Henry's recommendation to take him to Salt Lake, where it would have been much safer, we could have avoided that history. That terrible history there.
So he was the deputy sheriff. What other roles did he play here?
Yeah, so not long after he finished up deputy sheriff, he went in, studied law, the law books, you know. We actually have some of his law books, his old English law books from the, I think it's late 17th century, that I'll be bringing to the presentation as well. But he went into law, he passed the bar, he became an attorney here in town, his law office was originally located, people know Park City, the Crosby Collection Building, 419 Main Street. That was originally his law office. It burned down in the Great Fire of 1898. From there on, he was mostly involved in law and politics. He was appointed one of the first Park City attorneys. He was appointed by the city council. And then he was also elected Summit County attorney. And then, interestingly enough, he was, before Utah was a state, the probate judge for Summit County was a presidential appointment, and he was appointed initially by President Cleveland, and then President Harrison, and then President Cleveland again. President Cleveland's our only two-term president that served two non-consecutive terms, which is interesting. But yeah, he seemed to be influential in politics. Didn't matter the party. Both those presidents seemed to like his work, and then did private practice stuff.
It's really interesting. I wouldn't have thought that the Summit County probate would be a federal appointment.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, yeah, we have some of those letters that were signed by President Cleveland. It's pretty wild those days.
Now, before you made reference to the film Tombstone, and the stories we told so far give a real sense of the Wild Wild West. When he's becoming the prosecutor, were there still those kinds of adventures and those kinds of disruptive elements of his practice?
Yeah, I think He was involved in so many of these different cases on one side or another. He defended murderers through his private practice. He helped prosecute murderers. People attempted to murder him. And I also have a unique story that took place not far from here in the old Chinatown area where he was arrested. He himself was arrested for murder.
Okay, so let's talk about the attempts on his life. Tell us, why would people try to kill him, and how did it work? Obviously, it didn't work out.
Yeah. One of the stories that I have is from his time in Alta as one of the constables, him going to investigate things. Things weren't settled, you know, through trials a lot of times. It was gunfights, different times, and he would go looking for people, and they didn't want to go, and how do you settle things with a gun at times? So I have a couple different stories where people attempted to shot him. He dodged bullets. Somewhere an individual came into his law office with a gun and wanted to do harm. He knocked the gun out of his hand and I believe hit the guy on the head. Things were settled that way back then. It was much more common.
So before we go, I want to once again remind everybody about the details of the lecture. But before we do that, lots of great stories here. How much of this, how did you do the research? How much of this was sort of available in old trunks within the family? And how much of it did you have to go out looking at sources?
I think one of the interesting things, my mom was coming to Park City in the 90s and going to the library and looking at the old films, you know, that they had. And you're looking for a needle in a haystack. You would just look up a date. And so we weren't able to find much back then. And then I introduced her just last year to the vast records that have been digitized through the Marriott Library. So now you can go to the Marriott Library from the comfort of your own home, do a search, Henry Shields in this case, do the time frame, do what newspaper articles, and we got hundreds and hundreds of hits. So we were able to find more in a half an hour than years and years of looking at microfilm from the comfort of our own home, so she didn't have to travel and do all this. So a lot of it came from the digital files, family stories, obviously, some family pictures and family documents that we have as well. But I hope people realize with the digitization of everything, look online, your family ancestors. Everybody has a story just as wild as this.
Oh, I don't know about that. But we've been talking to Matt Melville. He will be speaking about his great-great-grandfather next Wednesday at the Park City Museum Annex, which is behind the Grubstake over by
the old liquor store.
Yep. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you so much, Roger.
We'll be right back after this. You've been listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Once again, you are listening to KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 81.1 FM in Summit County, 91.9 in Wasatch County. Stream us live on kpcw.org and the KPCW app, or just ask your smart speaker to play KPCW Radio.